Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's been more than half a year since the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus a global pandemic. The worldwide death toll from COVID-19 has now reached a new benchmark, 1 million deaths, 1 million worldwide. And that's the reported number, meaning there are most certainly more than that. So today, we will be checking in on other countries, Brazil, South Africa, and India, to talk about what's happening around the world, exactly who has been most affected by the virus, and by the response to it. So this hour on Point, the global pandemic and its disproportionate impact. And we will begin today in Baltimore with Dr. Alan Labrique. He is a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health on the faculty of the Global Disease Epidemiology and Control Program in the Department of International Health. Dr. Labrique, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Meghna. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the show, and I only wish I could be here under different circumstances.
I very much appreciate hearing that, and I wish also for every show practically that we've done in the past 7 months that we didn't have to do it under these circumstances. But here we are, and it seems as if not just in the United States, but now humanity keeps crossing these grim milestones. What were your thoughts when the world hit that 1 million deaths mark?
Yeah, it's a really tragic situation we find ourselves in, and one that we really should have been much better prepared for. As any student of infectious disease will attest to, even over the past several decades, when I was a graduate student in the 90s, we were reading CDC reports about pandemic preparedness and emerging viral threats. So with the expansion of human habitats, with the effects of climate change and unfettered global travel, we've seen even in the last two decades how quickly things can get out of hand with SARS and MERS, then H1N1, Ebola. So, this really was not something we were surprised to see in the global health community, but something that sadly the global body politic was unprepared for.
The global body politic. I mean, that's a key thing because in the modern world, you can't just rely on the fact that it's hard to travel between countries for containment because it is not. So what happens somewhere else on the other side of the planet matters everywhere. But so let me dig into some of these numbers here. That 1 million deaths mark, as I mentioned earlier, those are the reported deaths. Is there any way to know or estimate what the true number might be?
Yeah, so I think we'll be studying and learning more about this pandemic well into the years to come. I think as right now, the challenges in testing around the globe using similar standards, making sure that everyone who is presenting with symptoms of COVID gets an appropriate test and a diagnosis is not happening in a universal sense. So there are many countries around the globe where the burden of disease and death attributable to COVID is likely underestimated. So one thing certainly we will be able to observe in the future is what is the excess mortality that we observed in these uh-huh. past 8 months, in contrast to what we've seen in previous years. And I think that will give us a much more accurate, but also a much more stark picture of the real impact of this pandemic.
Mm. And so those are deaths. And of course, now we know, and we've known for at least a little while, that of people who have been infected, many people are suffering long term.
Absolutely.
With ongoing symptoms of COVID-19. Do we sort of what's the global rate of infection? Is this virus still spreading rapidly?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question, Meghna. I think we're seeing varied performance. I guess if you would grade countries in terms of how they're doing to control the spread of COVID, some places have been vastly more successful than others. in taking measures to stop the spread of this emerging pathogen. I think one of the things that we certainly expect to see is not just disruptions from long-term consequences of the infection, neurologic complications, cardiovascular complications, but in many parts of the world, COVID has disrupted decades of gains that we've made in global health, whether we're talking about vaccines of under five children, whether we're talking about nutritional improvements, gains in maternal and child health. And frankly, it's going to take years to undo the damage done by COVID-19, not just through the direct tragic losses of life that we've seen, but through the many indirect consequences of this virus.
Yeah, I mean, reading about the increase in world hunger, for example, is so disturbing. So this hour, we're going to be talking with people in three major countries worldwide, Brazil, India, and South Africa, to get a sense as to where those nations are with this pandemic and the impact that what's happening within their borders, what impact that might have worldwide. So Dr. Labrique, if you could just stand by for a second. Let's begin in Brazil. Now, in late April, after Brazil surpassed China in the number of coronavirus deaths, Brazil's president Jair Bolsonaro said or asked what he thought of the situation in his country. And here is what President Bolsonaro said. E daí? So President Bolsonaro, they're saying, so what? I mourn the deaths. What do you want me to do? My name's Messias, but I can't perform miracles. That was in April of this year. Well, joining us now from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, is Terence McCoy, foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, who covers Brazil. Terence, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, can you just give us a quick picture of sort of the status of the pandemic right now in Brazil?
The pandemic is just, it's a part of life as much as anything else in Brazil at this moment. It's something that people are, there's always been a chasm in Brazil between how people treated the virus versus how deadly and serious it has been. But that chasm, as the months has dragged on, has widened. At this point, we are still dealing with a very active outbreaks, very active pandemic. There's still tens of thousands of new cases every day. There's still hundreds of, if not a thousand, deaths every day. But in many parts of the country, life has returned to as much normal as people can. A lot of people wear masks, a lot of people don't. We're at this point right now where it's just kind of marooned in it. And although it is better than it was maybe a month ago, 2 months ago, it is still just this long plateau. And there's never really been a second wave in Brazil because the first wave never ended.
Oh, so Brazil has the third highest number of reported cases worldwide, I believe. What's driving that? It sounds as if you're like people are just shrugging their shoulders now and saying that's life. What's driving that?
I think it goes back to there has been incoherence at the federal government level as far as the seriousness of this. There's been a rampant confliction between what local officials say versus what Bolsonaro has said. He calls it a gripezinha, which means just a little flu, a little cold. He also says it is. And that's been a line that he has maintained from the very beginning. And then you have local officials who've said something different. When you have this conflict, this difference of how serious this is, you have a very confused population for how they're supposed to treat it. And that also then frays the trust that people have in being able to follow guidelines that they think they should have. And this comes at a time in Brazil, the pandemic in Brazil, when following decades of corruption scandals and fraying trust in the government and in democracy itself. So what this meant that is that there's not just only a lack of trust in the government, there's a lack of trust that people have in each other. There's a stunning study that came out a couple of years ago that said less than 10% of Brazilians say the majority of other Brazilians are trustworthy. And so when people don't trust that other people are going to follow the regulations, they're much less likely to do it themselves. And then on top of that, you have a federal government that has done everything in its power to advocate a policy of inaction when it comes to the pandemic and to continue living life as it always has been. And that then has pretty much mired this country in what we see today, which is more or less a purgatory of coronavirus that has just continued on for weeks and months and months.
Terrence, what you just said was absolutely fascinating. And since your line's a little shaky there, let me just repeat a little bit. So you said that there's been surveys done of the Brazilian people that they found that fewer than 10% of the Brazilian people thought that other Brazilians were trustworthy. So there's this sort of crisis in trust of Brazilians amongst each other. And then on top of that, a policy of inaction from the Brazilian federal government. I mean, the two things coming together... like you said, a purgatory of COVID-19. Now, on top of that, we've just got a minute to go before the break, Terrence. Brazil is a country of deep divides as well, deep class divides. How has that played a role here in the ravages of the pandemic?
I mean, everything in Brazil can be understood through the lens of class. And the pandemic has done nothing but magnify that perspective and widen the class divide. And you look no further than the very first death in Rio de Janeiro. The very first person to die in Rio de Janeiro was a domestic worker for a wealthy person who just came back from Italy. So the pandemic, the chronology of the pandemic in Brazil also can be understood through class. It was originally brought in through people who are wealthy from vacations in Italy and in the United States. And then it started to spread to lower class through oftentimes domestic help relationships. And then now once it gets to lower classes, it's been devastating. There has not been as much access to healthcare, and it also hit communities that already were dealing with other infectious diseases. And you've had a situation where people who are poor are dying in Brazil at a much higher rate than people who are wealthy.
Terrence, hang on here for just a second. Yeah, we've just got to take a quick break here. There's a lot more I want to learn from you about what's happening in Brazil. So Terrence McCoy and Dr. Alan Labrique, stand by. We're checking in with major countries around the world about where they are with the coronavirus pandemic. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are checking in on three major countries around the world, Brazil, India, and South Africa, about how or where those nations are, those important nations are in the global coronavirus pandemic. I'm joined today by Dr. Alan Labrique. He's a professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Terrence McCoy is also with us from Rio de Janeiro. He's a foreign correspondent with the Washington Post who covers Brazil. And Terrence, a couple of more questions for you about Brazil. I'm hearing sadly, the quality of our cell phone line with you degrading a little bit, so I'm gonna eke out as much as I can while we can still hear you. So you were talking about there's been a disproportionate impact on Brazil's poor. I wonder how much of that impact has further derailed Brazil as a nation, because it wasn't that long ago, half a dozen years ago, maybe a little bit more, that Brazil was this ascendant country. I mean, it was on the path to being this big global power. How different is that now?
I mean, there's a saying about Brazil that Brazil is the country of the future, and it always will be. And unfortunately, that saying is looking like it's coming to fruition once more. A decade ago, Brazil was ascendant, not just on a global scale, but also internally. There was a sense that a better life was there for the taking for those who had the courage to seize it. And what the last few years has shown, after there was this long-term commodities boom, is that middle-class lifestyle that people were desperately looking for was beginning to become difficult to reach. And all of those hopes that Brazil had of being able to take its next step on the global stage and being able to provide broad-scale prosperity for a population that has rarely had it in many segments, those hopes are being snuffed out by the coronavirus. Unemployment today is at the highest rate that it's been in the last three decades in Brazil. And the trend lines, long-term trend lines right now are not particularly good. It's mired in this sort of stagnation for a long period of time. But what it is right now is that when you have so many people have been sick, so many people have been mourning, so much uncertainty in the country, so much political uncertainty on top of it, it has derailed those aspirations to be able to take that next step, and it's unclear when Brazil will be able to right itself once more.
So it sounds like what the pandemic has done in Brazil is that it has simply exploded the weaknesses that were already there, even as Brazil was ascendant. Like you said, the distrust in democracy, in each other, the policies of inaction, the corruption, the class divides. It's almost as if what the virus has done is simply, it's just magnified the internal challenges that Brazil already has.
Yeah, it's magnified them all. And you see these things that were problems beforehand. Like, there's always been issues in the public health care system in Brazil. Brazil, honestly, has one of the best public health care systems in the developing world. It's a marvel of the developing world. Public health care system has saved thousands of people during this pandemic, but it's also because of years of disinvestment, years of neglect. It has not been able to weather the pandemic. Many people have not been able to get the care that they've needed. At one point, Rio de Janeiro itself, just one city in Brazil, the waiting list to get care, if you were a coronavirus patient, exceeded 1,000 people. 1,000 people couldn't get the care they needed. There are stories all over the country of people being turned away and not being able to get the care they need. Because they're going to the public system, they didn't have the money to pay for private health care. And in Manaus, the largest city in Brazil, there are stories, and I wrote a long story about this, about ambulance drivers that had nowhere to take patients. They'll just drive around for hours and hours, and they know where to go. They'll go to hospital after hospital trying to find an open bed, and they'll just get turned away. Or they're forced to barter what was in their ambulance. They're forced to barter a stretcher or a tank of oxygen to be able to say, will you take my patient? And they'll barter away what small medical supplies they had. And this is what was happening in the public health care system, and the public health care system is what takes care of the poor in this country. So you see these long-term trends that have just been magnified, as you said, by this pandemic. It was always there, but now it's just so much more clear.
So Terrence, last question for you then. And as all this is going on, am I seeing this correctly, that President Bolsonaro's approval rating is rising in Brazil?
Yeah, this is, you know, Brazil and the United States share a lot of similarities in a lot of different ways, and people like to compare Donald Trump with Jair Bolsonaro. There are key differences. One difference is that the base of support that supported Bolsonaro was not the rural poor. It was actually the wealthy, the middle classes, the people wanted to more and more economic austerity with the people who supported Jair Bolsonaro. But during this pandemic, the government has passed an emergency package which has given the poor sometimes more money than they've ever had before. It's like $150 a month, which for a lot of Brazilians is not much money at all. But for some poor people in Brazil, it's a lot of money. And what they're doing then is they're returning the favor to a certain degree, and they're supporting Jair Bolsonaro in numbers than they never have before. The reason Jair Bolsonaro is president of Brazil is not because of the poor. But right now, we're seeing a political shift in his base support. And the people who are driving that are the poor who are receiving that money. Mm. And so right now you have, in the middle of the worst humanitarian crisis in Brazil's history, 140,000 dead. Bolsonaro is more popular than he's been at any time since the beginning of his term.
Well, Terrence McCoy covers Brazil for the Washington Post, and he joins us today from Rio de Janeiro. Terrence, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Labrique, I appreciate you sitting back and patiently listening with me to Terrence's reporting there. What kind of trajectory do you hear Brazil being on right now?
Yeah, I think you know, as Terrence pointed out, pandemics and diseases, you know, through the ages have disproportionately affected the poorest and most vulnerable and disenfranchised segments of society. And they shine this spotlight on, as he pointed out, on these longstanding inequities that are only made worse during the pandemic. So unfortunately, the trajectory, I think, is one that's quite dismal. Things that existed before the pandemic, as he mentioned, reduced access to care, affordability, and we're seeing the same things echo in the U.S. with the inequities in the way in which the pandemic has unfurled here at home, with African Americans and Latino populations bearing the brunt of disease and deaths here in the U.S. So it's not just a Brazilian story, Meghna. It's happening all over the globe.
We will be hearing parallels for sure, echoes for sure. I'm really taken by Terrence's description of Brazil being in a COVID purgatory. Mm. I mean, you could say that the United States is in that same purgatory. And people seem to be like, when there's a vaccine, then, you know, we can get past this. But vaccines aside, for as long as major countries like the United States, like Brazil, are content with being in this COVID purgatory, it seems like the whole world will not be safe from this pandemic.
Yeah, purgatory more ways than one. I think the politicization of this pathogen has been very disturbing for those of us in the public health community. To see science being subjected to scorn and political challenge is fairly novel. Rather than confronting a virus that's affecting the entire globe as an apolitical entity, I think we've seen governments viewing their response as a reflection on their economic and social philosophies, right? And so if there's one thing that the pandemic has taught us is that no country is an island, right? We live in a global, interconnected world. Isolation and walls don't keep viruses out. So from speaking from our perspective, you know, global health is local health. And we have to target these threats together in a coordinated, joined approach. So I think that's certainly something we've learned and need to act on moving forward.
Well, let's now turn to South Africa, and there it seems again. Well, hearing these echoing themes this hour. Corruption has plagued the country's response to the pandemic. Here is an excerpt of a report from September, a report by DW Africa.
With over 600,000 infections, South Africa has been the country worst hit by the coronavirus on the continent. Yet it appears its response has been plagued with corruption. After public servants, members of the ruling party, ANC, and private companies were accused of looting from the country's relief fund, President Cyril Ramaphosa called for an investigation. Now the Auditor General has published his findings, uncovering major flaws and corruption.
Well, joining us now from Johannesburg is Adeola Oyenubi, senior lecturer at the School of Economics and Finance at Wits University in Johannesburg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let me first ask you, near the beginning of the pandemic, we did a program where we talked to a South African. And at that time, the thought was because of South Africa's experience with HIV/AIDS, that in fact, South Africa might do better than other countries in terms of managing this outbreak, this pandemic. with those hard-won lessons from HIV. Has that not happened?
To some extent, you could argue that that has happened, because I think, especially from the government side, they took the threat seriously early enough. South Africa announced a state of disaster on March 15th, and the whole country went into lockdown on March 26th. So from the point of view of early response, I think the government took the threat seriously.
Very seriously. I mean, South Africa's lockdown was one of the most severe lockdowns, right, of many nations, was it not?
Yes.
And I'm seeing here, I'm looking at sort of the curve of infections there. It was effective. I mean, the numbers started trending down in the middle of July. So where is the country now in terms of containing COVID there?
So from South Africa's point of view, it's we quickly realized that this health problem has other aspects to it, because the response to it, which is lockdown, has very, very serious implication for large sections of the society. So this in South Africa, a lot of people work in the informal sector. There is a lot of reliance on tourist visits and restaurants and stuff like that. So going into a hard lockdown meant forced labor market disengagement. So people had to practically stop working. Now, when you have a population where majority of the people work in the informal sector and cannot perform their work task from home, what that means is that those people don't have income. Mm-hmm. Now, instead of worrying just about the threat of contracting the virus, you're facing another threat now, which is people going hungry and people not having money, because people that work in the informal sector don't have a lot of savings. So they live almost every day on what they earn on that day. So if you ask them to go into lockdown, the longer the lockdown goes on, the more desperate they become, because without working, it means they are not going to be able to survive.
So this is the sort of growing concentric circles of tragedy around this pandemic. And
exactly.
So if you have people who are now on the brink in terms of their daily survival, because their basic subsistence is being taken away from them. And then on top of that, we have it seems as if these investigations into corruption around the response about looting from the relief fund. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so the story of corruption in South Africa started way before the pandemic. And the whole essence of there is a commission going on now that is investigating corruption since as far back as 2014, 2013, thereabouts. And there are even, as I'm speaking to you today, there are a number of government officials that have been arrested because of some allegation in 2014. So that has been there. So what happened during COVID is that because there is a need to respond quickly, it appears as if the corrupt individuals in government took that as an opportunity to even loot more. I mean, there are stories making rounds from yesterday and today that the province I'm staying in, which is Gauteng, approved a contract for 18 million. And the worth of that contract should be about one third of what it is. So on the one side, the government, in terms of the response from the government, there were social assistance programs like child support grant, old age pension, that the government sort of topped up, added more money to it. But the feeling you get from the government is that this may not be sustainable because the economy is struggling. Now, when you juxtapose that with the fact that you're hearing millions of rands disappearing into thin air almost every week, then it becomes very difficult to balance. The corruption problem is really a big one that makes it difficult for people to actually believe anything the government is telling them.
This is almost exactly what we heard from Terrence McCoy, who's reporting from Brazil, that there's just quite a profound breakdown in trust here. So how... I mean, in terms of the impact that the pandemic is having right now in South Africa, including or especially Adeola, those economic and food security impacts that you're talking about, what moves can or has the government made to help South Africans further now?
Yeah, so I must say the idea of topping up the child support grant, the old age pension, from research that I've done with some other people show that really helped to some extent. But the problem with that is that sometimes those are targeted towards people that have children. What happens if you don't have children? So there was a new grant that was introduced, but the amount of money we're talking about, for instance, for child support grant, it was initially 400 and something rand, which is about conservative estimate, like $50 per month. And you have an additional 300 rand added to it, which expires this month, actually, which means we go back to the normal amount of 430. But the number of jobs that have been lost, news report that came out yesterday and a research I was part of shows that we've lost around 2.8 million jobs. It took South Africa the last decade to create that amount of job, and we have lost that amount of job in 6 months. So the idea that
Adeola, can you just hold on for a second? I'm sorry, I have to take a little break here. I want to let you finish your thought about the idea of what needs to happen next. So hold on for a moment. We are checking in with major countries around the world about where they are with the coronavirus pandemic. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the global pandemic. We're checking in with major countries around the world about where they are with the pandemic, and we'll come back to that conversation in just a second. But I also want to let everyone know that we're at work on an hour about education in the pandemic, especially now that the school year has started again, whether it's in person or remotely, or a hybrid of something in between. And last spring, we had spoken with two education professors who said, you know what? This pandemic isn't just about shutting down schools. There's an opportunity to rethink education in the United States. So now that kids are back in school, however they are, did you see that rethink happen? What's working? What's not? Are the goals, the aspirations for what education should be, have they changed enough for you and your kids? So let us know how it's going. How are you coping? What we could do differently? What school looks like now and what you want it to look like? Call us with your stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And we'll use your stories for a show we're working on how to reimagine education in the middle of a pandemic. So back to our conversation now about countries around the world and where they are with the coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Alan Labrieke joins us from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And in Johannesburg, South Africa, Adeola Oyenubi is with us, senior lecturer at the School of Economics and Finance at Wits University in Johannesburg. And Adeola, you were talking about how it had taken South Africa a decade to achieve more than 2 million new jobs and fewer than 6 months to lose all those gains. And you were going to complete your thought on what that means for South Africa.
So, thank you. So what that means is that In terms of looking at recovery, we've actually, the government has relaxed the restriction. We have like five levels. The hard lockdown was level five. Now we're on level one and international travel is now allowed. But two things need to happen. Number one, there is a strong evidence that suggests that if those additional payments and social grants don't continue, then a lot of people are going to be in trouble, even with the relaxed restrictions. Two, the economy urgently needs to create jobs. And that's where the problem is, because the story that the economy needs to create jobs did not just happen in February when COVID happened. This has been the hymn we have been singing for years, but has never happened. So it becomes a bit hard to understand how that is going to magically happen now, after during this period, when we have not been able to do that for a number of years.
So so it sounds as if you're saying that the impact of what the pandemic has exacerbated in South Africa is going to last a long time.
I think so. Not only in terms of, let's even take an hypothetical situation. I made this argument in one of my papers. Let's even say we have a vaccine tomorrow. The probability that we're going to get all the jobs we have lost back like that, it's very low. Another thing is that there are psychological aspect to this. People that stay in poor areas where they cannot social distance and you ask them to wash their hands, but they don't have access to water, and all those things create some problem in terms of mental health, which are not going to go away, vaccine or no vaccine, quickly.
Well, Adeola Oyenubi, senior lecturer at the School of Economics and Finance at Wits University in Johannesburg, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
So, Dr. Labriek, two questions for you. First, respond to what Adeola is saying there, that it sounds like the emergency around joblessness and poverty and hunger in South Africa, again, exacerbated by the pandemic and the lockdown, you almost hear that there's greater urgency around that now than perhaps COVID itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, Meghna, we have to keep in mind that 3.5 billion people, that's a half the world's population, still struggle to meet their basic needs, according to the World Bank. And so that's almost 46% of the world's population that lives on less than $5 a day. So with the conditions of food insecurity, malnutrition, the fragile and economic health systems that are not just we're not just extant during the COVID, but I think strained by COVID, can easily send these fragile populations over the brink into desperation, as you said earlier. I think we've seen in countries like in India or Bangladesh, shelter-in-place orders were almost impossible to follow for large populations of internal migrant workers, like Adeola said, for South Africa, who live on a hand-to-mouth subsistence existence. And so I think this dependence on a daily income to survive makes it very difficult for citizens to follow the recommendations that were put forth to control COVID-19. So I think what we've seen is governments have a responsibility, and in some cases they did, to enable citizens to follow these recommendations by meeting those essential needs, providing food and shelter and healthcare, even during a time of a global pandemic. And I think what we've seen is making those recommendations, and I think it's sad to say, but the U.S. is a great example of this, making those recommendations without providing the economic resources for people to follow those stay-at-home and shelter-in-place recommendations are basically unfollowable. So you end up with with empty recommendations that people are just forced to violate because of basic needs.
Well, since you did mention India there, that's the last country that we want to get a snapshot of this hour. So let's do that. Joining us now is Jean Drez. Jean is joining us from Jharkhand, India. He's a visiting professor at the Department of Economics at Ranchi University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Meghna.
So give us a picture of sort of how the pandemic is playing out in India at the moment. Because as Dr. Labrik mentioned, there was that first very severe lockdown that Prime Minister Modi announced and only gave Indians, a couple of days to get ready for that lockdown that had a huge effect on migrant workers. But what's the situation in the country now?
Right. So, Meghna, I think that India is going through a huge tragedy, if not multiple tragedies. But we have to be clear about what kind of tragedy it is. So starting with COVID, since you wanted a broad brush picture, India has recent cases, and the actual infections so far are probably more like something like 90 million, which means that India is going to overtake the United States very soon in terms of recorded cases, not to speak of actual infections. And if you look at the new recorded cases per day, it's pretty close to 100,000 per day now in India. It's way ahead of any other country in the world. It's like more than twice any other country. And all this is still rising quite fast. Of course, we have to remember that India is a very large country in terms of population. So in per capita terms, it's still not as bad as the United States. But things are still getting worse, although in the last few days, there has been some sign of improvement. The silver lining as far as COVID is concerned is that the mortality rate seems to be quite low, perhaps something like one death per 1,000 infections. And that means that the deaths from COVID are still a very small proportion of the total mortality. Right now, we have about 1,000 deaths per day. And it seems like if India is lucky, it's going to stagnate now around 1,000 per day and stopped rising. 1,000 per day, of course, is a lot. It's about 3% of overall mortality, which is not insignificant. But frankly, most people, and especially poor people, of course, are far less afraid of getting infected than of the unemployment and loss of earnings that they are suffering and suffered even more during the lockdown. That has been pointed out already in the case of Brazil and more so for South Africa. But we have to remember that India is much poorer than both of those two countries. And there's a lot of evidence that large numbers of people have faced severe food insecurity during the April-May lockdown when the whole country was more or less shut. Just to give you a couple of examples.
Jean, can you hold on for just a second? Because you said something I want to just get very quick clarification from you on, because your line dropped out a little bit. You said that India was going to overtake the United States, and then we lost your line for a second there. Overtake the United States in what?
In recorded cases.
Okay, and is that right? so it's per capita or absolute?
No, absolute. But, you know, I don't think we should pay too much attention to these recorded cases, because in the case of India, recorded cases is maybe 1/15 of actual total infections so far. So we should not pay too much attention to these cases. I think what is more useful to focus on is the deaths. Okay. And that's why I mentioned 1,000 deaths per day, 3% of overall mortality. That is a serious crisis, but it's not such a serious crisis of mortality that we should continue with the sort of extremely harsh lockdown measures that were taken in April and May and even in June, which wrecked the economy. I mean, the decline in GDP in that quarter of the year was almost 25%, the worst for countries for which we have that kind of data. And GDP is not the main thing. The main thing is what happens to people's earnings. Now, if you look, for example, at urban workers, according to a recent large survey by the Center for Economic Performance at the London School of Economics, 50% of urban workers did not earn anything during the months of complete lockdown. And if you look at the migrant workers, which is something like at least 20 million people in India, they suffered earnings decline of 80% on average. That led to in particular, an increase in food insecurity. 78% of 25,000 respondents in a nationwide survey in the month of June said that they had found it quite difficult or very difficult to feed their families during the lockdown. So it's a level of poverty and insecurity that is much greater than almost anywhere in the world. And finally, we have to also remember it's not just the threat of infection or the decline in earnings and incomes and employment, but also the breakdown of public services, including many essential services that matter a lot to poor people, including health services. If you look, for example, at the number of patients in healthcare centers, the outpatient departments in the healthcare centers during the lockdown, it was only about 50% of normal. Even institutional deliveries declined. Child immunization declined. In some states, they more or less collapsed. And that also affects the quality of life of poor people. So that is what we are facing today. And of course, now there is a little bit of economic revival and the revival of public services as well.
Well, Jean, let me just ask you one last question because we're rapidly running out of time here. But is the Indian government in a position to provide more direct food assistance, more direct economic assistance to states or directly to the Indian people? Okay, we'll see if we can get Jean's line back up here. But we're actually also only down to 3.5 minutes, so hopefully we can. But Dr. Labriek, I really want to know about two things. Yeah. One in terms of what could have happened, and then the second thing about what will happen. So we're with Brazil, South Africa, and India here. We have major nations struggling a lot, you know. And their struggles sound very familiar in terms of the kinds of struggles we're facing here in the United States. I keep thinking of, you know, we've done hours on, you know, South Korea, New Zealand, the nations that said that had a different path. And one of the things that they did, yes, the economic picture of those nations is very different, but also there was sort of the immediate testing and tracing, all the things that we've talked about that could have happened. If that kind of testing and tracing had been instituted in the United States, Brazil, India, and South Africa, could these nations have been on a different path too?
Absolutely, and I think you've pointed out what we call COVID-19 exemplars, right? These are countries where recent experiences with epidemic disease, SARS, MERS were fresh in their memory. So they had systems in place as a response to that, that they were able to reactivate in very short order. So one of the things that we're finding globally is it's not so much how many things you do, but how fast you react and implement these interventions that make a major difference. So having those legal, technical, clinical pieces in place allowed for these countries to suspend temporarily certain rights, but also to implement government support mechanisms to be able to bolster public health actions like the ones you recommend, sheltering in place, immediate testing and tracing, and even work shutdown to some extent. You look at the example of New Zealand. The Prime Minister came on and said, look, we were going to shut down for a very limited number of weeks, but a high level of adherence will enable us to go back to normal in short order. And so this sort of unified national response is really another major lesson that we take away from these positive exemplars.
Well, can I just say, so we've just got 30 seconds left here. And now, you know, it occurs to me that we've been looking through this narrow keyhole of the pandemic, but the big lesson coming out of this hour is that all the other impacts are going to be with the global community, with humanity, for so much longer, even after the SARS-CoV-2 is out of the picture.
Absolutely. I think we're going to, as I said earlier, going to take many years to recover. And I think there's going to need global investment. But I think what we've also learned is that we have to listen to and allow science to guide policy. It works, and it has worked in countries around the world. So unfortunately, with the political situation around the globe, we've seen less impact than we'd like to. So hopefully in the future, we'll learn from this and move forward in a positive direction.
Well, Dr. Alan Labrique is a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And earlier we heard from Terence McCoy in Brazil, Adeola Oyenubi in South Africa, and Jean Drez in India. Thanks to them again as well. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.